Hello and welcome to the Metrospective presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70, celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. I'm Ted Berg, joined as always in Zoom conference by the Athletics Mets beat writer Tim Breton, who is zooming in from San Francisco. We are recording this late Wednesday night, actually slightly past my normal 9:45 p.m. bedtime, because this is a very, very special edition of this podcast. The Mets won a game.
Yeah, they won a game on Wednesday. They snapped their five-game losing streak. They did it by coming back in the ninth inning against Jake McGee to tie the game. They took the lead in extra innings. They lost the lead in extra innings. They took a bigger lead in extra innings and held on to that one in a 6-2 win. I believe that was the final score. I like that, you know, like, we're recording this. It is, you know, past your bedtime, as you said, on the East Coast. And initially, when we were texting about this, I suggested a time in like the 9 o'clock hour on Wednesday. And you took that to mean AM, because that's when we usually record. And then we had to agree that I was not going to get up at 6 AM to do the podcast on the West Coast. And that was good, because had we recorded, started recording at 9 AM on the East Coast on Wednesday morning, that podcast would not have been relevant for that long, because something happened shortly thereafter this morning.
Yes, it did. And it is one of the many things that, so when I was watching even into the late innings of Wednesday's game, I was, you know, knowing that we were going to be recording this show afterwards, just like mentally preparing an absolutely furious rant, and like, with even considering like a late night coffee to get myself up for it, because the Mets have been playing so badly. And then, like, enter Captain Obvious. I wish I should have pulled up the tweet, but I don't know. I think, based on the responses, it seems like there are still some Mets fans out there who have a lot of patience for owner Steve Cohen, and I am not among them. So, like, I don't even know how to read this in a way that would make it sound like I'm not partial, but he says, it's hard to understand how professional hitters can be this unproductive. The best teams have a more disciplined approach. The slugging and OPS numbers don't lie. Which is like, what? I don't know. What's your point?
What voice is that you use with your kids?
I don't, that's not a voice. That's just, I was just like, that was just, I couldn't come. I wanted to come up with a sniveling voice, because it felt like a sniveling tweet for me. You're the owner of the team, bro. Right, like the like, everybody knows the buck stops with you. You hired the front office that acquired these players. You know, you signed the contracts or didn't sign the contracts to acquire more players. And also, like, what good does this do? Like, the slugging and OPS numbers don't lie. Like, oh, like, are you writing about baseball in 2003 here? But I don't know. It just. You know, yes, the best teams have a more disciplined approach. Is he saying the Mets don't? Because, like, that's not usually what I think is the Mets' problem. It's that they don't hit the ball when they choose the pitch to, you know, it's not like, oh God, these guys are crazy free swingers. The crazy free swinger is the only guy that they brought in at the trade deadline, right? Is Javi Baez. The rest of the Mets are pretty disciplined hitters. They're just not good.
Yeah, you know, it's not pointing out anything that anyone who has watched this team doesn't know already. Like, you know, we've talked about the offense since like April 15th this season, not being what the Mets expected coming into the year. I do look at the timing of his tweet on Wednesday morning, the same way I look at what Zach Scott said as the acting general manager last week when he talked about them being very mediocre for much of the season. Both of those instances came the day after Pete Alonso talked post-game and kind of espoused a certain positivity that doesn't generally sit well with the Mets fan base. You know, this is not a fan base that is, you can easily BS. And I think you know, both Cohen and Scott in those day after situations, I was going to say availabilities, Cohen's just doing it on Twitter, decided that they wanted to appear kind of more accountable to the hardened New York baseball fan. And I think this is a tweet that's not meant for his clubhouse, that's not meant for his front office, that's not meant for his coaching staff. It is meant for the fan base to see that he is also frustrated. I Luis Rojas was diplomatic about it earlier on Wednesday. You know, he said the players were taking it the right way, and that You know, they understood where he was coming from. They are also frustrated with their offensive performance. And, you know, Kevin Pillar after the game said that it was a, you know, it was a topic of conversation among the players. You imagine it's not like their favorite thing to see on a Wednesday morning by the, you know, coming at a time before they probably woke up on the West Coast. And that, you know, like the thing with offensive struggles, when your team is bad offensively, it looks lifeless, right? You know, like if the Mets had a terrible pitching staff, and we've seen this in the recent past, if they had a pitching staff that went out there and blew games constantly, at least you would have a lead at times, right? Like it's less, it doesn't seem as demoralizing early in the game when you have a bad offense and you fall behind 3-0 and it feels like it's over and it seems lifeless. It seems like your team lacks urgency. It seems like your team has no heart. All of these things that people like to throw around when a team is struggling, especially offensively. But it's not something you fix by trying harder. It's not something you fix by like swinging harder to up your exit velocity or something like that. You know, this is the part of baseball that is the difference from the other sports. You know, we keep asking as reporters, like, you know, do you guys have a sense of urgency here? I don't know what that looks like for a baseball team.
I don't think you a sense of it, right? Because the main thing they always say is like, oh, don't try to do too much, right? So like you don't want, and that's true. That's true if you go to the batting cage, right? Like if you go into the batting cage and you think like, I want to hit the hell out of this ball, you're going to swing and miss or you're going to foul it off. And if you just think like, if you don't think really is the key, that's when you hit better.
Yeah, so you know, like in football, you can run your offense faster, you can play more aggressive defensively. In basketball, you can press as a sense of urgency within an individual game or something like that. In baseball, like, you know, you might put guys in motion on the base paths more often. That's not a good idea for this team. Like, we know that.
I was absolutely sure that Jonathan Villar was going to get picked up, become like what would have to be one of the first ever free runners on second, picked off immediately.
You know, I think the frustration is tangible from the entire organization. You know, like I don't get too upset about like what Alonso says after a game.
I wanted to ask you about that. Do you think like, okay, so you're saying that Cohen and Zach Scott sort of were acting in response to Alonso, but do you really get the sense that Mets fans don't have patience for Pete Alonso's positivity? Because and I might be wearing like glasses colored by my 9 and 13-year-old nephews who just absolutely worship Pete Alonso, but it seems to me like everybody sort of like got a feel for who this guy is and understand that like this is what Pete Alonso is about. Like he's gonna be this like sort of like goofy, positive smash bro dude, you know?
Well, I think, you know, certainly that Sunday in Philadelphia, they get swept. You know, Wheeler pitches the shutout against them. And both Alonso and Rojas were very positive after the game. And I would, you know, I wrote that they were coming off as naive. And I think every other beat reporter probably wrote something similar. And I know that the broadcast teams, both the television and radio, kind of mentioned the same idea. And you know, if you get in on Twitter and you look at the response to Pete Alonso and in the immediate aftermath of him saying those things, it's not overwhelmingly positive, like right on, Pete. Fans are frustrated. And I think this is one thing I worry about with Cohen on Twitter, like what he tweets out, like whatever. If he's tweeting what he thinks, that's fine. I think your concern would be if you are trying to be an objective evaluator of the New York Mets, an owner who is very much in tune to what's being said on Twitter is probably not a great thing. You know, baseball.
I mean, have you ever worked for anyone like that? Because I can promise it's not a good thing.
Like baseball is you evaluate the forest, not the tree, and Twitter just throws twigs at you constantly. Like that, you know, and so you need to be able to take the broader perspective on things. And, you know, you wonder, is Steve Cohen thinking this way about the team? Are his opinions about the team and where it is affected at all by the deluge in his mentions after every game?
It's a good question. And like because on one hand, it's like, well, this guy has to be smart, right? Like, I don't know. I don't even know if that's true, right? Because like, I don't know from enough hedge fund guys to tell you, like, it seems like these people are probably smart. I don't fully understand what a hedge fund is. I don't own a single stock. Like, I don't understand any of it. So I think, but like, at the same time, I'm pretty sure I'm fairly smart. So it's not like, I don't think that necessarily, it just depends on what your goals are. Like, I've never been eager to master finance, and obviously he has, and he's done it. I don't know enough about that world to say, like, you become worth $10 billion exclusively by being like the most shrewd money guy, or there's a little bit of luck and randomness in there. I tend to believe that there's at least some of the latter. But you have to assume he's a pretty smart guy, right? Like, I don't know. It bothers me, Tim. Like, I don't know what else to say. It's like, because I know he can't hit, right? So, like, what are you trying to tell me, that I wish this team had a better OPS? Like, that's what you have to say for yourself? I don't know. It's just so, it's like, it seems like needlessly needling players who already know they're underperforming from the owner's box as like this sort of like vague threat to, but it's not clear who it's, I don't know. I just, since the education time tweet, I have no patience for this guy. That's just going to be true. Like, that's it. That was the turning point for me, and it's going to be hard to undo it.
Yeah, first of all, on the intelligence thing, I think we often conflate wealth with intelligence as a culture.
But hedge funds seem so confusing that you assume they have to be smart.
I mean, like, you can be really smart in very specific areas. Like, I am sure that Steve Cohen is a very smart person when it comes to hedge funds. I feel pretty confident, like, I'm a smart person when it comes to the inner workings of, like, the 2000 New York Giants as a fan, or, like, the 1999 NLCS. Or like Crime and Punishment, the novel. I could talk intelligently about those things. That doesn't mean that I'd be good at running a hedge fund. It doesn't mean I'd be good at running a baseball team. And I think too often we think this person is good at this one thing. That means they'll definitely be good at this other thing. It doesn't mean they can't be good at it, but we have to see it happen. And I think that's the same case with Steve Cohen. I think, who is Steve Cohen as an owner? And this is, I'm giving a sneak preview of what I plan to write. I haven't written it all. I have a draft. It might, by the time you listen to this, maybe it's posted. It's not just like the most pressing question around the Mets. Like, we can talk about what do you do with qualifying offers and how do you handle various personnel decisions, and Luis Rojas is the manager. The lot of fun questions for the Mets to answer this offseason. The most pressing one is, who is Steve Cohen as an owner, and how does he want to operate as an owner? Is it someone who is going to take the broad perspective of things? Is it someone who's going to want to shake up more things than he did initially? Does he want to put in the plan that he initially had last November that has kind of been wrecked by various things? They weren't able to hire a president of baseball ops, and they had to fire their GM, the guy they put in charge to hire both the president of baseball ops and the GM. His last two hires are both on baseball's ineligible list right now. So maybe you don't put him in charge going forward the next time, but that's a decision they have to make. Like, how much is he going to change what his November 1st, 2020 plan was this offseason? Because he didn't get to enact it the same way he wanted to last offseason. I think that's the most interesting question around this team. And, we're getting to the point in the season where you're starting to think a lot more about the offseason mm-hmm. than the last 6 weeks of the regular season.
Well, yeah, and so you brought up last offseason, and we've discussed at length, and while you were gone, I discussed with Andy McCullough at great length the concept of, Dodgers East and how the Mets go about becoming the Dodgers. And I don't think I really even considered, until watching the Mets play the Dodgers, just how very far away that is. And I almost feel like I deluded myself at times this season into thinking the Mets, I think that I haven't adjusted maybe my expectations for what a great baseball team looks like in 2021. I think that there is less parity in the sport now than there was probably for most of my formative years. And what struck me with the Mets playing the Dodgers was I just got this idea in my head, like, okay, what if the Dodgers were told, hey, we're folding the Mets right now, and you can take any and every guy you want from the Mets active 25 roster, active 25-man roster. how many Mets would the Dodgers take? Like, I'm not, it sounds mean, but I'm not even kidding. Like, I think they would take Brandon Nimmo. I think Brandon Nimmo replaces Billy McKinney immediately. I think that you'd rather have Pete Alonso as your righty bench bat than Albert Pujols. I think you take Jeff McNeil over Matt Beatty as sort of a lefty hitting utility man. But Nimmo is probably, and Nimmo and Marcus Stroman are going to be like the only guys playing big roles, I think, at all on the current Dodgers team. Like, if it's not to knock the Mets players, it's just to emphasize like how incredibly good and deep the Dodgers are. And then, you know, you see the Giants and this is something I talked about with Andy McCullough as well, is that, you know, these sort of scrap heap type guys, the Farhan Zaidi special, it seems like, that are now established in Los Angeles in Justin Turner and Max Muncy and Chris Taylor, making their way in San Francisco, in your Lamont Wade Jr. and the resurgent Darren Ruff. And so it's hard to know, you know, that these guys are legit. But even if you stack up the Giants to the Mets, it's like there would only be five or six Mets that the Giants would want. You know, and you look at the Brewers, and it's like they have three of the top six pitchers in the league, and then a bullpen where every single guy is lights out. And there's just like, there's no aspect of this Mets team right now that feels like it stacks up anywhere close to the class of the National League. And all of those teams have at least one thing that's like superlative. And there's nothing about the Mets that really, since Jacob DeGrom went down, there's nothing about the Mets that like jumps off as like, okay, well, this guy or this unit or this this defense or anything where it's very good. They're like, they have some things that are okay and some things that are pretty good and some things that are bad and like nothing that's great.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next, you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Visit DirecTV.com. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Well, I mean, I think both the Dodgers and Giants, they would take all 26 Mets players. They would,
they could stash them in the minors.
Maximize their roster by putting, you know, using options in
there. No, but I'm serious about that. Like, how many guys, if it was just active 25-man roster for the Dodgers right now, active 25-man roster for the Mets right now, how many guys do the Dodgers want?
Yeah, let's see. They feel good about Will Smith and Max Muncy and Chris Taylor. They would need a shortstop because Gavin Lux is their. I guess Corey.
No, Seager's back. Sorry. And they have Trey Turner. They have two shortstops, better than any active shortstop on the Mets.
This is what happens when you're just going down the baseball reference list.
I cheated. I've spent a lot of time looking at this.
You know, Cody Bellinger's only got a 70 OPS plus this year. So.
Right. So it's like, but he can play center field, and the Mets don't really, right? You're not gonna take Kevin Pillar or Albert Elmora Jr. over Cody Bellinger, right? Like, you're going to take your chances with Bellinger.
Yeah, I mean, like, Nimmo might be playing there, but right, he's replacing McKinney on their bench. I mean, you go down, there's probably some bullpen guys, right?
Maybe.
Kenley Jansen having a nicer season. Phil Bickford is having an excellent season. I didn't know about that.
There's like maybe Blake Treinen is having an excellent season. Corey Knebel, who has been, he's been out for a lot, but he's been good since he's been back. Like, there's like maybe they take Edwin Diaz as like a mop up guy. Like, I'm not even kidding. Like, they're just so much better than the Mets.
Yeah, I think, you know, I wrote around the trade deadline that, you know, one of the things that was obvious, that the Mets lacked, that the Dodgers and the Giants both had as teams that made big trades. The Dodgers, the one with the Nats, the Giants, the one with the Cubs for Chris Bryant, was that second tier of prospect. You know, you can have the top guys. The Mets are pretty good there, but they lacked the second tier of prospects, which made them a non-starter, really, in conversations for Bryant from what some of the reporting by like Andy Martino has pointed out. Made it difficult for them to get like Jose Barrios as well. You know, those types of guys, they're just not deep enough in the farm system. That takes time, and clearly, some of the moves they've made in the recent, you know, the last 4 years has made it difficult for them to have that kind of prospect depth. especially with not signing Kumar Rocker. The other aspect of it is, like, what are you doing to develop players? Because mm-hmm. clearly, what you mentioned, the Farhan Zaidi special, like what the Dodgers have done over the last several years, what the Giants have done in the last couple now, is take guys who are not particularly productive elsewhere or even within their own organization and make them better. You know, that Buster Posey and Brandon Crawford are having the best seasons of their careers right now in 2021. That they're, like, you know, Brandon Crawford is a very legitimate MVP candidate in the National League. That is wild. And so what can the Mets take from what those teams are doing with their own players, with guys you have in the system, to make them better on a regular basis? You know, you're looking at the Giants lineup and the Mets lineup coming into this season. Which one would you have picked to be better based right. off the names you've got there? You wouldn't definitely take the Mets. You would probably take the Mets.
I think you would definitely take the Mets.
And San Francisco has gotten so much more out of those players. You know, I remember Ben Cherington talking about it. Like, we talked about it last podcast that I was on, with the difference between, like, the 2013 Red Sox and the 2014 Red Sox was you had one team where everyone seemed to operate at, like, their 80th percentile possible projected outcome. And then the next year it was like everyone's at the 20th or 30th percentile. Mm-hmm. And that's the difference between the Giants offense and the Mets offense.
Right.
Is you've got guys in San Francisco operating at the 85th percentile of what you could possibly think they would do this year. And with the Mets, it's much lower than that. And that's... You know, you've got to look internally and say, how can we make these players better? It's not about, like, trade everyone. You know, it's not about trading J.D. Davis or trading Dom Smith or trading Jeff McNeil or shaking up the mix. It's how do you get, like, these guys are good Major League Baseball players. You've seen them be good Major League Baseball players. How do you get the most out of them as an organization? And how do you do that with a whole host of players in your system, not just the top guys?
Right. And that sort of leads to another point I wanted to make, which was another thing I sort of got diving deep into in Baseball Reference, and this notion that, like, the haves and have-nots in baseball has gotten a little bit more extreme, definitely more extreme, makes me think that there are teams, as you reference, like, doing things that the other teams are not. And so in recent seasons, like, the Dodgers pitching has been incredible. The Indians have been, or the Guardians now, the Cleveland baseball team has been so good at developing pitchers, especially, like, taking on sort of, like, college AAA non-prospect type guys and turning them into really good pitchers. And now the Brewers, it seems like, have maybe figured something out in the pitching department. Check this out. So sorting by ERA plus, which is a park and league adjusted stat, right? So it's anchored to league average. This is not a reflection of the league's pitching getting better. This is a reflection of team's performance as compared to the team to the league average. From 1969, when they first lowered the mound, through 2011, only 11 teams ever had an ERA plus of 125 or above. And you know, 125 being 25% better than the league average. That only happened 11 times. All of those teams, unsurprisingly, were really good. And five of those times, it was the Braves of Glavine, Smoltz, and Maddox, which makes sense. Since 2015 alone, that has happened 13 times, including, and part of this is small sample size in 2020 and still in 2021, but the 2018 and 2019 Astros were above 125 plus ERA plus. The 2019 Indians, the 2020 Reds, the 2020 Indians, and then the Dodgers last year, the Dodgers this year, the Giants, and the Brewers. So it's like all of these extremely good pitching teams, all of a sudden, just there's so many more teams performing so much higher than the league average than normally happens, which makes me just think that, like, maybe the have and have not isn't so much in your spending ability, which you see in the Dodgers and you see in the Giants, but you don't really see in the Brewers, right? So much as it is in terms of, like, your knowledge of how to make your players better.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've seen, like, you know, in the from like 2003 through 2016 or so, it seemed like no one really won 100 games.
Mm-hmm.
Like it was very rare that a team won 100 games. You know, you certainly didn't see like multiple teams win 100 games in the same league, let alone the same division. And now in the last few years, you know, the Astros have won 100 games several times. The Dodgers won 100 games several times. The Yankees have did it at least in 2018 when they finished second in their division with a more than 100 wins, mm-hmm. I believe, to the Red Sox. You know, and I think that's a product of, like you said, it's a lack of parity because you've got more and more teams that are not trying.
Right.
And so you've got kind of a larger group of like good players going to a smaller group of teams because they're the teams that are trying. And I think that, you know, we've had also like some of the worst bullpens in baseball history over the last couple of years. We've had some of the worst offenses, some of the worst pitching staffs, in addition to some of the best, because you've had the Orioles, you've had the Tigers, you've had like this year's Diamondbacks. You've had some really bad baseball teams over the last several seasons to counteract the really good ones. And so, you know, we didn't see that quite to the same extent a decade ago when, you know, if you won 96, 97 games, you could be hosting the first round, you know, you'd be hosting a division series. I think it was Astros Dodgers in 2017 was the first, I believe that was the first postseason series between 100 win teams since like 1980 or something like that.
Right.
Since I believe like a Yankees Royals ALCS. In the 80s, late 70s or early 80s. So you went, you know, that long without it happening. And now it happens every October because you've got to get to 100 wins to be pretty good in your league. And it does seem like, you know, for a while there in 2011, 2012, 2013, like you didn't have teams that did it really wrong. You know, you had like Dave Stewart's Diamondbacks didn't seem to operate on the same principle as everyone else. But basically that was it. You had teams operating kind of under the same principles, and moving in the same direction. So it was kind of a flatter landscape. You know, I remember covering the American League East at that time. Like, they, you know, every team won the division within like a 6-year span. And now there's still the couple of teams that aren't quite up to speed, Colorado chief among them, I think, probably right mm-hmm. now. But then it's just like other teams have taken it to the next level. And that is LA, that is San Francisco, that is Tampa, that is Houston. Cleveland with its pitching staff, Milwaukee, like you mentioned, like certain teams do things really well, and that's separating them from the pack. And now everyone else has to catch up again.
And so an interesting flip side. I'm glad you mentioned the 2017 Astros, who we know had a certain advantages on their side, and namely Carlos Beltran, the wise and gifted garbage pail whacker man. But so I wanted to see if the opposite was true, or if the revert, like that offenses were also sort of trending more extreme. And long story short, like there are more top end offenses now than there were traditionally throughout baseball history. The three best by OPS Plus, again, which is anchored to league average, the three best offenses in Major League history were all Yankees teams that Babe Ruth was on, followed by the fourth best OPS Plus of a team in baseball history was the 2017 Astros that I just mentioned. Fifth best was the 82 Brewers, which was a huge year for both Yount and Molitor. Sixth best team in Major League history by OPS Plus. Do you know what it is?
Was it last year?
It was the 2020 Mets. And I will
I was gonna
tell
say,
you,
yeah, because they were like 121, right?
They were at 121. And of all of the teams that have ever had an OPS plus of 115 or above as a team, which is 35 teams, 34 of those teams have winning records. And the only one that was not a winning record, it was like nowhere even close to a winning record. And again, it's a small sample size, but it was those 26 and 34 2020 Mets, the sixth best team in sixth best hitting team in baseball history.
You know, I think that's, it's interesting to diet. I mean, this is a longer topic of conversation. Like the Mets OPS plus last year, I think, was good in part because of the park factors of Citi Field, and that Citi Field didn't play like Citi Field usually plays. So I've gotten confirmation on this, by the way. We talked a few weeks back about the theory that the exit velocity was suppressed at Citi Field, and they thought it was because of the baseballs and how they were stored. And that is the reason the Mets put in a humidor in 2020. It was because they thought they were storing the baseballs in too humid an environment. And so they put it in a humidor. It seemed to solve it in 2020. It's gone back to normal bad stuff in 2021. But it is weird to think this offense was so successful last year. And there were some results where, Dominic Smith was on a pace for like 90 extra base hits. You did not expect that to repeat itself. You would have expected streaky hitter like Michael Conforto to experience more of a slump this year than last year. No one would have thought that both of those guys would be well below league average at this point, as well as Francisco Lindor, that Jeff McNeil would be right around league average, that really outside of Alonso and Nimmo and JD Davis in a limited stint because of his injuries, would be having a good offensive season for this team.
It has been a weird and frustrating season, but it's not over. And now they're back at 500. And I thought the win tonight, as we speak again Wednesday night, encouraging, makes you feel like there's a glimmer of hope in this world. And maybe the Mets will pull back into this thing somehow. It doesn't feel likely based on how they've played in the games before this one. But, the win makes it feel better. We have a question. This comes from Kevin, who's asked us some questions before. He says, he's got another question for us. My wife and I are expecting our first child. Congratulations. She is a Red Sox fan and I am a Mets fan. Do you have any advice for raising a child in a divided fan household? Tim, do you have any experience with this?
I don't. I have not raised a child, let alone in a divided fan household. Growing up, we were basically all, my parents didn't. They liked the Mets. They didn't like push that on us or anything. I would just let your child make the decision himself, herself. They can decide at a certain point. You don't need to, other people will probably buy Mets or Red Sox gear for them. They can wear that unthinkingly. I wore tons of Marlins and Rockies gear in 1993 as a 6 and 7 year old because that was the hot seller at the time. My brothers had worn a lot of Hornets stuff that didn't affect who we rooted for. So just let it happen naturally. Don't see what kind of connection you make with your son or daughter based off of just watching the games with them.
Yeah, I think that is the key. And I think that is also the type of thing that maybe you worry about a little bit before you have the kid. But once the kid is there, you're like, I don't care what baseball team this kid roots for. I need him to sleep at the night. I want him to be willing to eat vegetables every once in a while and smile and be happy. And then whatever team you pick, kid, is fine by me. I don't know that everyone feels that way. And I don't know if that is a reflection of my jadedness or maybe my wisdom, but it's I don't know. My wife is nominally or her family are Yankees fans. She's nominally a Yankees fan, I guess. She's sort of become a Mets fan over time. If there's so few teams I could find that would be more despicable for me than my child becoming a Yankee fan. And if my child became a Yankee fan, I'd be like, all right, great. It's actually way easier to get to on the subway. I'm good with that. And moreover, maybe even more likely because he's a child coming up in 2021. Both of my children are, I say this is, that was extraordinarily sexist of me to go straight to my son when discussing baseball fandom, but my daughter is 1 year old and doesn't express many opinions yet, other than that she wants the food. But if they both become Yankee fans, so be it. Or if they both don't like baseball at all, so be it. I don't know. I think it was something I remember having a conversation with my friend. I think my son seems like, and this is when he was like a baby. He was, maybe 9 months old, and I was reading things. I think he's really into music. Like I, I think, like, you know, I'd love to get him playing music. He is still really into music, and I would love to get him playing music. And my friend was like, oh, really? Like, do you want to go that route? That means, like, you're going to have to go to recitals, and you're going to have to go to, like, this, and you're going to buy instruments. I was like, I don't care. Like, that's fine. Like, if that's something that he likes and makes him happy, then great. And if the Mets is just going to be my thing, then that's fine by me. If not, if, you know, like, if they want to participate in watching the Mets with me someday, they do now because I have him on and we have a very small apartment. If that's something they grow interested in, like, of course I will nurture that. But I don't. Yeah, I say just play it as it lies, right? Like, see what your kid turns into and what they like, and you'll be fine with it because, like, that's not something to disown your child for.
Yeah, like, one thing I've always appreciated is my dad raised three, like, sports mad sons who were into, like, everything sports, and none of them really had any affinity really for the sport, the only sport that he loved, which was golf. My dad still watches golf every Saturday and Sunday, and we don't, his sons. I always appreciated that he didn't, like, get mad at us for not being good at golf, for not playing a lot of golf. I tried briefly. It didn't work out. Same for my baseball career, actually. That he just enjoyed, you know, we liked other sports and he enjoyed watching us play those because we were better at them than the golf.
Yeah, my dad, not a big sports guy. Like, he just sort of became into, I don't even know if he's in, you'd say he's into sports now. He's into watching his children and grandchildren play sports. And so he certainly attended many, many sporting events, but, like, just not a particularly huge sports fan on his own. Like your dad, willing to tolerate the sports fandom in my household. And I think, parental tolerance would be my main bit of advice. Like, whatever they like, as long as it's not dangerous, like, that's fine. It's just, like, the basic human needs you got to worry about first.
Number one, keep child alive. Number two, decide on fandom.
Not the Yankees. Like, not the Yankees. Let's not go Dodgers. And then, like, don't try to be funny and be a Marlins fan. That's all I got, Tim. You should go out and enjoy San Francisco while you still can.
Yeah, we'll see what the town has in store for me. I think I'm just gonna, like, pick up dinner and then go to sleep.
Well, that sounds like a good time to me because I can't wait to go to sleep. So peace out.
Adios.